With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello and welcome to Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast. I'm Benesh Maid, and this week we look back with a series of 2 episodes that attempt to explore the music, the man and the myth of composer Sir Harrison Birtwistle in his 80th year in 2014. There is a lot written and discussed about classical music, but ultimately it's the music which needs to talk to you, to connect, to take you somewhere. Often that music is not made alone.
Good collaboration is a game of ping pong. And in collaboration, you always want a good collaboration, is they give you something within the context of what you're talking about, but even more.
On this first episode, we'll learn more about the composer through some of his biggest collaborators. To understand the composer and his process, we speak to critic and author Fiona Maddox. Her book, Harrison Birtwistle, Wild Tracks, attempts to understand his love of music, food and the countryside as he reached this milestone birthday.
We're in the Royal Opera House to talk about Harrison Birtwistle. This seems like a very good place to start, though. I presume you got to see some of his productions here.
Well, it's the place that Gawain was premiered and returned with great success for revivals, and also the Minotaur, which astonishingly was sold out at the last revival.
You wrote this book on quite a big, incredible figure in classical music. How did it come about?
It was rather like the way people suddenly realised the millennium was approaching. About the day before, people suddenly said, oh, it's the millennium. Equally here, the publisher, Faber, prompted by me, suddenly realised, oh, it's Harrison Birtwistle's 80th birthday, which I'm sure is on the same level as the millennium in terms of musical importance. We thought it would be impossible to write a biography itself in that time, and maybe he wouldn't want it anyway. But the idea came about to have conversations, and we've called the book a conversation diary because sometimes 2 or 3 times a week I'd go to Wiltshire to see him and just talk about what he wanted to talk about that day. So it wasn't in any sense chronological, though there's biographical early childhood elements, but it was very much trying to see how he spends his working life day to day as a composer. He kept saying, I don't want to read this book, I trust you, he said, which is a great burden of responsibility and one that I'm rather nervous about.
You've mentioned a lot of stuff already, but maybe set the scene.
I think the place he can be found a lot of the time is his kitchen, or if it's not absolutely freezing or raining, his garden, both of which are en route to his studio at the end of his garden, which is where he works, and that's a wooden hut raised from the ground. You go up steps to it, and it's like a little den of warmth, which is his alone. I think he said it was 72 steps from the kitchen, the back door, to the studio at the end of the garden, and on those steps he would look at his trees that he was pruning, or plants that are growing, or fruit that needs picking. And those rhythms of life are absolutely part of his daily routine. And he loves to cook, he loves to grow things, he loves to cook things, and the combination is as crucial to his life as writing music, I think. And probably in many ways he brings the same freshness and excitement to pulling up a bunch of radishes as to writing an incredibly difficult part for solo trumpet.
Is he a person who kind of considers writing music like an office job, in the sense of doing a certain number of hours every day?
even if he doesn't always do those hours or those pages or that number of minutes worth of music, I think he does take that very seriously. And there's no one less likely that you'd find in an office behind a little desk with a little computer screen. He works on huge sheets of his own self-designated, self-designed manuscript paper, which he pins on big boards in front of him. And he works with pencils, rulers, pencil rubbers, even clocks and a sort of stopwatch to work out how long something's going to take, or metronomes, obviously, to work out the speed. He has a keyboard, which is an electronic keyboard of no great... I mean, it sounds rather tinny to my ear. It's not beautiful, but he doesn't work at the keyboard at all, but as far as I know... I don't know that he works to an absolute timetable, but I would guess that he likes to be at his desk by a certain time soon after breakfast and will work through till, I think, the exhaustion of sitting in one position, force the end of a working day. And then he likes to cook. But one of the things that we seemed to talk about each week I went was his quinces, which were growing in the garden and which on trees, obviously, and that he was pruning and which finally... came to fruition about the time that our conversations ended in early autumn.
When you sort of getting towards the end of the process, I'm interested to know what sort of conclusions and dots did you start joining, maybe ones that even the composer didn't realise were there?
I had no sense in which I could make things happen. I mean, I was grateful that the quinces did their thing and produced themselves, and after being talked about for nearly 6 months, ended up being in the bowl on the kitchen table where we were talking, and would indeed end up being made into jam. I thought, thank you, quinces. That sounds laughable. But one of the other things that was going on during that period was that he had started a big work for piano and orchestra. And that was another of the strands running through. One of the things that each week, in addition to examining the garden or the weather or the fish pond in the garden, we talked about how he was progressing with the piano concerto. He was just at the point of nearly seeing an end in sight and beginning to find a title for it. So his generosity in all respects was, and also his modesty, but someone who's achieved so much and yet could still be so full of self-doubt, that was very, very touching.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Do you want food? Here's food. This wine is my best.
Born the 15th of July 1935, over 80 years ago, was Sir Harrison Birtwistle, or Harry, to his friends. But let's attempt to learn more about the composer and his upbringing through a collaborator who shared the same surroundings, singer Sir John Tomlinson.
The part of Northern England where I come from, and where coincidentally Harry Birtwistle comes from as well, Accrington, is situated in northeast Lancashire, about 20 miles north of Manchester. A place like Accrington and Oswald Twistle, where I was brought up, were textile towns when I was a boy. There were rows upon rows of terraced houses. There in the valleys, there's the factories, the mills, the factories, quite a few pubs, a lot of Methodist chapels. I was brought up as a Methodist, a strong Methodist. Sometimes you'd have two Methodist chapels facing one another across Union Road, the main road, thousands of terraced houses. And it was, a very industrial landscape, mainly textiles, mining, manufacturing, and the vast majority of people who lived there were working people, people who went down the street in their clogs at 7:45 in the morning when work started, and came back home. The Industrial Revolution started in Lancashire. A couple of hundred years before, that's where an awful lot of had happened. George Hargreaves, who invented famously the spinning jenny, one of the mechanical developments for the textile, was born and lived in Oswald Twistle. Now, in the 50s, of course, all this started to fall apart, and it's now very much a post-industrial landscape up there. The work for textiles went over to the Far East. To cut a long story short, Lancashire was, to some extent, de-industrialised, and the mills were run down. They were used for other more mundane products like dog biscuits or chest expanders and all sorts of things, I remember. And so I suppose it was very much a society sort of in industrial decline. That's as I remember it. when I was a boy, everything was black. You know, the railways were trundling along the whole time, pumping out the black smoke. The factories were pumping out black smoke. All the houses were simply black. Now when you go up there, it's the lovely original millstone grit stone, you know, which is a lovely stone. So that's all been restored. Elgar Howarth conducted the Gawain and the Green Knight to start with, and I suppose in the canteen at Covent Garden there would be Elgar Howarth, there'd be Harrison Birkwhistle, and there'd be me reminiscing about Lancashire. You know, we're all sort of northerners, so there was a little bit of a northern mafia going on in those days. But what is northernness? That's a question. I think straightforwardness. I think honesty. Not the most diplomatic, probably. Very good heart. Very basically friendly. Shooting from the hip a bit. At its best, I think, certainly in Harry's case, he's extremely clear-thinking.
So, opening Birtwhistle at 80 at the Barbican on May the 16th, 2014, was a concert hall staging of the composer's iconic opera of the 1990s, Gawain. This marked the first collaboration between Birtwhistle and poet David Harsent. I'll speak to David in just a moment, but first academic Jonathan Cross on the success of this relationship, followed by a follow-on thought from the composer himself on the myth and ideas behind the music.
I think for any composer, finding the right librettist is a difficult job, and when you hit the right one, you stick with him or her. So this was the first time that these two had collaborated on Gawain, Harsent and Birtwhistle, and they've subsequently produced a large number of very important pieces. The Minotaur is one, but also song cycles and so on and so forth. There's something very important about that relationship. He knows that the ideas that the librettist is working with are in tune with his own ideas. He knows he can work with him. He knows the librettist is going to deliver the kind of text that he can set. Harsent too is interested in these ancient tales with a kind of ritualistic way of presenting narratives rather than it being more prosaic, let's say. So yeah, the ideas and the way of working of these two figures, though very different, are clearly very much in tune with the results that we see and hear.
They sort of found me, the subject matters, and the subject matters of these intrinsically basic, you know, fundamental fairy storying, the way of telling stories. And in a way, it was given me, and they chose me. I don't want to find a sort of psychological... In the end, it's about music. And I don't want the subject matters to get in the way of it. And then there's a question of identifying the sort of music that I think I write that would suit the material. Many people ask me this question about how do you find the subject matters, but they find me, or they found me very early on. Yeah. And it seems to also that you can deal with the subject, the sort of subjects I deal with. You can't do it in sort of ordinary, what you call spoken theatre. Of that, the idea of myth and the thing is, one thing helps the other in the way that it's expressed.
We'll hear more from Jonathan Cross in the next episode and more from the composer himself later on. Now to the University of Roehampton to meet up with its professor of creative writing and the librettist to Gawain, the Minotaur and many more collaborations, David Harsent.
He telephoned me out of the blue. I got a phone call one day from Harry saying, would you like to write an opera with me? And I said, yes. I'd seen Punch and Judy, which I thought was a fantastic piece of work. The reason that Harry called me was that I had written a book-long sequence of poems called Mr. Punch. And in reviewing that book for The Observer, Peter Porter, the Australian poet, had drawn parallels between the book and Harry's opera, Punch and Judy. And Harry, I guess, had seen the review, and I suppose went and got the book, liked what he saw, or liked what he read, and called me. So I said, yes, okay, what's it about? And he said, I want to do an operatic version of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And of course, for any English poet, that's a benchmark poem. We then had several meetings to talk about the piece, and it was, I think, after about the third meeting, as Harry was leaving, I said, oh, by the way, where's it going on? I sort of thought, well, the Drill Hall, perhaps, which is where I saw Punch and Judy. And he said, well, the Royal Opera House, main stage. So I was very pleased by that notion, yeah.
So it's obviously something you're proud of, but something that was a very steep learning curve.
It was, yes. In fact, I think there was a point after I'd started writing, maybe I'd been working for about a week, when something occurred to me and I phoned Harry and said, will there be a chorus? what I realised I was doing, and it's never been otherwise really, was writing a stage play that would in fact be set to music. But what will happen is, Harry and I will have quite lengthy conversations about the piece and the way it's going to go. With the Minotaur, for example, we immediately came together on the fact that we didn't want it to be overpopulated. When we were talking about how the Minotaur might open, I'm not quite sure who said it first, but it was almost as if the other person had completed the sentence. You know, why don't we have her on her own, on the beach, waiting for the ship to come in that's carrying the Innocence and Theseus?
I wanted to delve maybe a little bit deeper into how you approach setting these tales, fables, myths, stories.
Well, I think it's occasionally, I used never to accept commissions for poems. You know, somebody would say, I'd like to commission you to write a poem about this, that, or the other. And I used to think this was kind of, you know, it wasn't the muse. And then, I won't go into why, it's quite a long story, but I was offered a commission by Jo Shapcott for an anthology that she was editing. And because of a misunderstanding, I wrote a different version of what was required. But it was a commission that freed me into, or somehow kick-started, the book that became Legion. So I then began to think, the real thing about commissions is what's in this for me, okay? And I have accepted a number of commissions subsequently, which where I've thought, well, there is something in this for me. There really is. I think it's not so dissimilar, you know, from an opera's commission after all. So, you know, I looked at Gawain and thought, what's in this for me? Similarly, the Minotaur, ditto the Corridor. I mean, I look at it, it's the new piece that we're doing, which I think is Aldeburgh next year and the Linbury and one or two other places, which is the other side of the evening from the Corridor. It's called The Cure, and it's a pre-Euripidean Medea. It's about the moment when Medea and Jason arrive back in Iolcos with the Golden Fleece, and Jason says, you know, I'd like my father to be able to join in these celebrations, but he's old and near death, and can you rejuvenate him? And she says, yes, I can, and I will, because she's a witch. And, you know, I looked at that possibility to see what was in that for me. It's always, of course, a version of the story, and it's going to be my version, but it's going to be Harry's version too. And that's why we talk so much before we start about, you know, the way the thing's going to go. And, you know, myth is very interesting to us. Well, when I'm just talking to Harry about anything, we seem to go quite deep, quite fast. Well, I did say once, just before the Minotaur was staged, first stage, that if Harry and I had a dream about the Minotaur, it would probably be a version of the same dream. We do think alike in that sort of a way. It's very interesting. What Harry does is he works through, to some degree, through sketch and illustration, diagrams almost, you know? So we were at my house talking about how we were going to make this new piece, The Cure, work. And I got little scraps of paper about sort of 4 inches by 4 inches that are for phone messages. It's just old manuscripts of mine that I've torn up, you know. And I got a small handful of those and I started to write something down. And Harry said, look, and he reached across and took 3 or 4 of the pages. It starts like this, and he drew a picture, he drew a diagram, and then this, and another diagram. And suddenly I was doing this too. I was saying, so look, here, and it was a V lying on its side, and it represented something in the piece. And we both started working on that, but it's happened before. I'll have a notebook, and I'm making notes, you know, while we're talking, and he'll take the notebook off me and start drawing, you know, what he wants. We can both see what we both mean by looking at it diagrammatically, which is interesting, I think. Never done that with anybody else.
We should be speaking to Alison Chitty, and she was so important for the Minotaur.
Yeah, well, Ali is a very, very good designer. I mean, she has such clever ideas. You know, I sometimes look at what she's done. It's the same with Paul Pyne, who's lit a lot of our stuff. You look at what Ali's done, and you think, oh, God, she's so clever. She is so clever. You know, how did she arrive at that? That's so good. Yeah, she has, you know, sort of what you want in a designer. I mean, she's thinking ahead of me. I mean, if somebody said, what would you like this to look like? I mean, I'd have all these kind of, you know, rather obvious ideas, I expect. You can always count on Ali to come up with something that really, really works but is unexpected.
Another big collaborator, one who was just mentioned by David, is Alison Chitty, someone who takes the music and translates it into her own visual language, covering every detail the opera audience sees on stage. Gathering some string and attaching it firmly to one end of the podcast, let us enter further the mind maze of Harrison Birtwistle. I spoke to Alison.
Well, I met Harry at the National Theatre because he was a resident composer there, or head of music, I think his title was, something like that. And I was a resident designer there. And we spent a lot of time talking and meeting in the canteen. But the minute we started working together, we really enjoyed that very much. And certainly a very, very key moment was when we were working on the late Shakespeare's with Peter Hall. And we were in hours and hours and hours of rehearsal. And at one point, completely nothing to do with what we should have been working on, Harry said to me, if we were to cut somebody's head off and they had to carry on singing for 13 minutes, do you think you could do it? And I said, yeah, sure, I'm sure we could. Thinking, oh, goodness knows what this is all about or how I'd be able to do it. But I thought yes was the right answer. That was the sort of first moment that we had talking about Gawain, although I didn't know it at the time.
When did he actually say, look, I've got something coming up and I want you on board?
I don't think it was very long after, actually. I don't think it was very long afterwards. And of course, it was early days for him. He hadn't written anything. He was thinking about it. And I think the following, it was probably within the next year. And then the following Christmas, I was going to stay with some friends in France. And he said, well, come and visit me because I'm not far away. I went to see him for 3 or 4 days and I took my sketchbooks and my pencils and everything. And when I got there, he still hadn't written anything. He hadn't started. But I thought I was going to do sort of 3 days intensive, you know, get up to speed with everything. And I'd read it. And, you know, we didn't have a libretto even at that point, I don't think. And that was just a very, very gentle early talks about it. Then we came back to London and things really got going. And the most marvellous thing about everything I've ever done with Harry's, because he's creating it, is I've just sort of been alongside while it's started to turn into whatever it's going to be. I mean, Gawain, it was really new territory for me, although I'd done small pieces of his. I remember looking at bits of the score with him, which I could sort of read music, but not really. I sort of have a visual relationship with reading music. And in fact, Harry taught me to read these shapes and these sort of amazing sort of great shapes of many, many instruments, all sort of doing a massive rise and fall in the middle of the piece. And I don't know, I began to work with him in that way. And all the time drawing. Whenever we're working, I just sort of draw and show him things.
Yeah, I'm interested to kind of go further into the sort of the creative process. I think from what you said and speaking to other people, he sometimes has key moments and key characters in mind, like the Green Knight.
Well, I mean, that's a gift for a designer, of course. And the casting was phenomenal with John Tomlinson. So, I mean, it was just heaven as a project. And heaven because it was, you know, it was in Harry's area of myth, although it isn't exactly myth. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful tale. The great thing with Harry is that you can show him things and he's got a phenomenal eye and a wonderful aesthetic and he can say yes or no very, very quickly.
What do you think attracts him to these stories, or maybe what attracts you to these stories?
Oh, I'm led by Harry there. It's not my first love, although it's sort of become a great love. It is not my, I don't know, I don't have a first love really. I like storytelling in the broadest sense and the psychology of all that. And if it's two people living in Hackney who speak to each other or two people living in Greece who sing to each other, I'm still as passionate about trying to work out how you do that. I don't know for Harry. It's a very, very good question. And it just feels right for him. I can't, because he's so incredibly contemporary, but his work is so hugely classical. It feels right. It suits him. It feels like the right coat to be wearing. But I would love to see him do, I'd love to hear him write something about those people in Hackney. That would also be great. And it is that complete trust in what he feels about things, in terms of whether they're right or wrong or whether, but anyway, he knows. I mean, he's invented the thing, and I don't know. And because I I like to say we share an aesthetic. We care about the same kinds of things. We like restraint. We like things expressed in a very simple and distilled way. And presumably that's why he asked me to design the next opera every now and again, you know. But no, I think we share that aesthetic, and also we're very preoccupied with storytelling and the clarity of that and the simplicity of that. And he's sometimes very disarming because he says, well, what do you mean? What do you mean there isn't going to be any, I don't know, in Gawain there aren't going to be any dead animals? There have to be dead animals. You know, what have they killed? How are we doing that? Where are they? You know, and there's no way you can say, oh, well, I thought that maybe, you know, I mean, you've got to deal with it. And it's only just a reminder, but it's a simple clarity, which I like very much. And we share that, I think. The only other thing I was going to say was about working together on the Minotaur early on. Stephen Langridge, who directed the Minotaur, and I went to Wiltshire and worked with Harry in his studio when he had, I think he'd written probably the first, I don't know, half an hour or something. And he showed us the score, all handwritten, absolutely exquisite. There needs to be an exhibition, actually, of just his scores. I mean, they are the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And this was our sort of first session with him. He just took us through it. I mean, there was no, you know, I can't read music and understand. When I look at something, I can't hear anything. I don't have that skill or ability at all. And but he took us through it moment by moment. You know, this piece starts with, you know, 45 seconds of the lowest note that you can possibly imagine in the history of time. You know, then there's silence, then there's 3 minutes of, you know, whatever. And Stephen made notes, we both made suggestions, and I drew. And I now have this series of drawings, which was, you know, the first half an hour of Minotaur. And some of it was connected and some of it wasn't, and some of it stayed. It was interesting. Yeah. I mean, we had to work out how to express this sea, this rolling sea, you know, and very, very, on that very first day, we were drawing about how we should deal with that and what we should. Anyway, that is such a fantastic work process. I can't tell you. So, you know, people say precious or whatever, you know, I mean, it's just really, really good.
Yeah.
And surely the best work must come out of a director and a designer and the composer all working together with that. You know, obviously the libretto has already been written by David Harson in that case. And so that is established and it evolves a little bit. But, you know, we're then working from the libretto and creating, you know, this next. I mean, it's marvellous.
I'm trying to get a sense of scale and work involved in a production. I mean, maybe for the case of the Barbican, let's go back to Gawain. But could maybe you think of the smallest item that you've designed through to the biggest item, and the sort of fill us in on what's involved?
Well, this is a sort of a week's work now to talk about this, how to be a designer, what you do, all that. Really hard. Yeah, I think my mantra is always about simple storytelling, clarity, distillation, simplicity, restraint, no clutter, the whole thing driven, the whole nature of whatever you make on stage driven by what happens and what it is, rather than anything that you would lay on top of it. And I've always called myself a designer, not a decorator, and I think that's very important for me. I mean, when people say, what do you do? I always say I design everything you see except for the lighting. And that goes from somebody lifting up a cup of tea to, you know, the whole of the Grail Hall appearing in Parsifal, which I've just done recently, which is on the larger side. But, you know, I was thinking about, you know, you're saying about little things. Anything, even if it's a hanky in somebody's pocket, I want it to be the right one and I want it to be the right colour. The minute they bring these hankies out, you know, they can, you know, you have everybody wearing grey and somebody brings out a red hanky and blow their nose. The spirit of that moment is totally changed. If they bring out a grey hanky, nothing happens.
I wanted to talk about the idea of success because a lot of Harry's work, which a lot of the work that you've been involved with as well, has been a fantastic success. Why do you think they've captured the public's imagination?
Oh, lots of difficult questions. Well, they're epic pieces, aren't they? But, I mean, well, they're not all epic pieces. Some of them are charming, little, exquisite miniatures. You know, I wouldn't say in a million years that I understand Harry's music or anything. It's completely disarming. It completely takes you over. It's thrilling. It's fantastic. It's surprising, exciting, you know. And I'm sort of hooked on it, you know, and I imagine that's what's happened to audiences too. And he's doing extraordinary things all the time. By that, I mean that you wouldn't want to miss the next one.
We talked about we started with the severed head. One of the other things that's come up quite a few times in various interviews is it's been described as the best, the most exquisite pantomime horse.
Yeah, in Gawain with the Green Knight's horse. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you don't know what you're going to do. When you start designing something and you read the libretto and you read that this Green Knight is going to come into King Arthur's court on a green horse, you think, fine, okay, yeah, so what's the next thing? Oh, yeah, and then the door's got to knock. You know, and thinking back, one of the ways in which we developed that horse was we did some workshops. And if anybody ever thinks it's not worth spending any money on workshops developing new pieces, it's completely wrong. I mean, we spend a week or 2 weeks, I think, developing Gawain with a group of actors. But in the end, I mean, that was just the practical reality of how we were going to get John sitting up at horseback height. In the end, it was irrelevant, that, because what its nature was on the outside made you believe it was a horse. It was nothing to do with the two brilliant guys who were inside, actors, phenomenal, who in the end we put in Dr. Martin boots. So they had sort of kind of hooves. I mean, it's completely nothing to do with period, but it felt good. Their movement was fabulous. But actually, its surface, and a most wonderful prop maker, Duncan Dow, who then ran the Royal Opera House, has a great skill for making sculptural things. And he and I worked together on this, and I really give him credit for making it so magical and completely realising what was sort of my dreams, you know. It was a marvellous thing.
Of himself, dark.
Well, let's talk about the Minotaur, because, I mean, half man, half beast, you know, we know, not least from Picasso's wonderful drawings, what he could look like. But the driving factor for John's look in the Minotaur was when we realised, and again, we didn't realise this early on, but I remember Stephen coming to this very studio and saying, but do you realise he sings for, I can't remember how long it is now, 17 minutes or something. And we'd got various versions about how we thought he might look, and we actually sort of invented it here. We just started.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I just started drawing, as Stephen was saying, talking about the problem. Out of that drawing, sort of that head became a reality, which was just to take the contours of the shape of and to make it as a great skeletal shape, but at the same time use John's body and how he was to make the man's shape. I mean, as we developed it, it went on and I took the spine down his spine. And that, I think the spine only came out of something that John said when we were in rehearsal. That was very late on the spine and it was gorgeous, that detail. It basically, you know, Stephen was saying, sorry, he's got to sing, how are we going to hear him? And, you know, I was going, oh, what are we going to do? And out of that, I mean, it, you know, some I think sometimes people think that the director sits in one study, you know, with his head in the score and a libretto, and the designer sits in a studio with a head in the score and the libretto and with a sketch pad and a model, and then you sort of, it's all done and you put it all together. But it's absolutely backward forward collaboration, which is completely, you know, and there's nothing like anything to focus you as somebody saying, well, what do you mean? I mean, they're not going to be able to sing that. What would it be like? And you think, oh, I better think of something very quickly. And you do. And I've got the sketchbooks with the development of that drawing. We then, having done the drawing, I mean, we worked with John. I mean, he was so patient. We worked with John for months on this thing. We started the head probably a year early before we even went on stage, because we thought if this doesn't work and everybody isn't happy about it acoustically, there is no show. And we went backwards and forwards. Claire Murphy, the costume supervisor, and I went backwards and forwards down to John's house with samples of shapes and taking photographs of him. And my final costume drawings are out of those shapes of his body and putting these kind of, but to get the proportion right and then make it work acoustically. And then I can't remember exactly what point we had the idea to light up the structure inside so that when he became the man, that suddenly John's face was stronger. I mean, it was never really strong, but it was stronger. I can't even remember who thought of that, but you know, key part of what that, I mean, I'd like to say mask, but it isn't, it's a sort of head. Key part of what that was, that we would light it from the inside. Very difficult to do, you know, but gorgeous, gorgeous in the end. And John's patience with the fittings, we used to count the length of the fittings by how many cups of tea he had to have. So we'd say, this is a five cup of tea fitting. Sorry, John, you know, this is only a one-er. This is a quickie, you know. I mean, and for him to stand around in his knickers with a head on for hours and hours. But we all loved working together, and we'd all work together on Gawain and just kept on going. I'm not saying it's always easy. I'm not saying it's always a pleasure, because it's incredibly hard. And I mean, I've got drawings of the Minotaur. This is how sad my life is. You know, when I'm sitting in bed, waking up at night, drawing things that I'm thinking that maybe that's another way for it to go. How can we pull all this together and get this to be, you know, marvellous, though. I've just had the most fantastic time working with him, and we're just about to do another one. Hooray.
And finally, we were given a rare opportunity to speak to the composer himself. I found him in his London-based publisher's office in a rare trip out of his Wiltshire home. So let's find out his thoughts on collaboration and whether he was particular about who he worked with.
Are you very picky, put it that way? Are you very, very picky about who you work with?
Well, I would be. I mean, with David Harson, we have a very interesting relationship in that sense. And it's an understanding and... got it very much at the moment now. And good collaboration is a game of ping pong, mm-hmm, or tennis, yeah. I have mentioned things to Alison about something and which she will take on board. But she take on board the essence, you know, not a complete description. And if she doesn't do it, she would have a... It's because she's got a better idea than I do. Yeah. And in collaboration, you always want a good collaboration, is they give you something within the context of what you're talking about, but even more. Yeah, you do something you would not expect to be there. And that has certainly happened in the production of things. And I had... I've seen productions of my things could not, as far as I'm concerned, could not be worse. But then I've got something. At one time, a few years, 2 or 3 years back, I had two productions of Punch and Judy in London, exactly the same time. And one production was very good, and it's an old production, and I've seen it before, perfectly, really, really good. I said, oh, God, I'm not going to have to see another one. Yeah? And I couldn't... it was so good. It was done... The Young Vic? You could not... And also, it brought about... It brought things into it, you know, that I could never imagine would be there. So there are good things and bad things. I mean, the point about the notes and music is formed, and the amount of what you can do with that is pretty set. And the rest of it is finding the truth of something and telling and actually telling, finding a way of saying what it's about and exactly what we've just been talking about.
A different collaborator, maybe even someone, I mean, who's be described as a muse is Sir John Tomlinson, who was obviously in Gawain and then the Minotaur and other pieces. How did that sort of relationship begin, and what do you see in him, and how do you write for him?
Well, we go back a long way because he sang in the first production of Punch and Judy, I think. Yeah, I'm sure he did. I'm sure he's on the recording anyway. Yeah, I think he was on the recording. And I think that I've had a sort of eye to the possibilities of things that I've done which were parts for him. I'm sure that it chose him in Gawain. But I think that in the case of the Minotaur, I'm sure that it was somewhere in my thing that it's a suitable thing for him to do. Yeah. But to write for him, well, it's sort of there when you write for him, and I don't think specifically I like to think that I have good instinct for it.
Is it nice? I mean, get somebody else who's involved is Martin Brabbins. Should it be taken for granted that someone maybe understands your music, who's experienced, and you were saying right at the beginning of the interview about how your music should be heard a few times. Is that the same from the performer's or conductor's point of view?
Yeah. But you do get sort of situations... not so much with conductors. I never know what conductors think. I never know what some conductors think. One of the things that they have to, I got to have the psychology of the orchestra in that if they get the sense that the conductor's not with the music, then they're not going to be with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've just had a performance in Ireland and of Earth Dances. Now, it's one of the most difficult pieces of orchestral music ever written in some ways. It was done. It was wonderful. I'm not saying that technically it was, absolutely, because there wasn't enough rehearsal. There's never enough rehearsal, yeah. But it was certainly in the spirit of the music and played absolutely. I thought it was wonderful.
Maybe compared to how you would hear it on the record, there's just something, if they get it right, there's something electric in the room.
Yeah, well, performance. I mean, that you've got the word. There is an electricity, and this you get a sort of sense of the audience, and it's got to be there though. There's got to be enough people.
On the next edition, we take a journey into the layered architecture of the music itself and hear again from the composer alongside those who have first-hand experience of being inside this living and breathing form of music. We hear, amongst others, from conductor Martin Brabbins on the composer's legacy.
If you're a composer or performer, you want people to listen to you. You want people to hear your music. So, you know, there will, of course, be a part of him that is absolutely thrilled. He's got such a lot of incredible original music inside him that we should all be very proud to have him as a British composer, because, you know, he really is one of the greats now, and he's one of the elder statesmen of the musical world, and we love him for it.
I'm Ben Eshmade. Thanks for listening to this archive edition of Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast. Here to inspire more people to discover and love the arts with weekly episodes of archive finds and theme series. Subscribe to Nothing Concrete on Acast, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you can, leave us a review to help us get the word out.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.